Iran that claimed the lives of 4 military personnel and 1 civilian. NAM called the attack a violation of the fundamental principles of international law and the UN Charter. The bloc reiterated that Iran has the inherent right to defend itself against such aggression. It also asked the UN Security Council to condemn the attack and work toward preventing it from happening again. The bloc said the Council's inability to hold Israel accountable has enabled the regime to continue its aggression in Palestine, Lebanon, and elsewhere in the region. More death and destruction in the Gaza Strip as the Israeli regime continues its genocidal campaign and keeps pounding the blockaded territory with air and artillery strikes. An Israeli strike hit a house in Gaza City, killing 2 children along with their parents. 6 people, including a mother and her 2 children, were also lost their lives in strikes on the central city of Deir al-Balah. Over in the north, the regime's latest attack on Beit Lahia left at least 25 people dead, with many still trapped under the rubble. Israeli forces also attacked Kamal Adwan Hospital for a second day, wounding medical staff and patients, including newborn babies. This is while the humanitarian situation in the northern strip remains catastrophic amid the crippling siege. Since the onset of the war in Gaza, nearly 43,400 Palestinians have been killed and over 102,000 others injured. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Education, some 12,000 students are among the dead. Moving on, condemnations are pouring in following Israel's decision to cut ties with the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA. Hamas condemned the regime's move, saying Israel is trying to eliminate the Palestinian cause and their right to return home. It called on the international community to oppose Israel's decision and to help strengthen UNRWA amid the Gaza genocide. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad also slammed the decision, saying that it directly targets the rights of Palestinian refugees and disrupts delivery of basic humanitarian services to them. It urged the Security Council to take a firm stance and to expel Israel from the General Assembly. The Gaza Government Media Office also called for the expulsion of Israel from international and UN institutions over its war crimes. UNRWA has warned that the move will lead to the collapse of humanitarian work in Gaza. Dozens of UN member states and 2 organizations have submitted a joint letter to the world body calling for a halt in arms supplies to the Israeli regime amid its ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. The letter has been signed by 52 countries, including Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, Algeria, China, Iran, and Russia, as well as the Arab League and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The letter highlights the Israeli killings of civilians, including women and children, in Gaza over the past 1 year, in violation of international law and UN resolutions. It calls for collective steps to bring an end to Israel's occupation and to deter its violations in Gaza, the occupied West Bank, and Lebanon, as well as its regional escalation. Despite the global outcry, the Israeli regime has continued with its genocidal war on Palestinians in defiance of verdicts by the International Court of Justice and the UN Security Council resolutions. Pro-Palestine protesters have held a rally near the French Football Federation in Paris to call for the cancellation of a Nations League match between France and Israel.
Israeli football players, they are half players, half soldiers, because when they are not on a football ground, they are on a war ground, because they are soldiers, reservists, and they have been saying nothing, not any protest about their colleagues, Palestinian football players that have been killed, more than 200 since 1 year, for 1 year, and then they are racist. They don't like Arabs, they don't like black. How are they going to play with the French team, which is full of Arabs and black football players? How can we do that?
Video footage shows some protesters went inside the Federation's headquarters holding Palestinian flags. They also carried placards reading no to the France-Israel match at Stade de France and Champions League of Genocide. Anti-Israel sentiment remains high in several European countries amid the Israeli genocide in Gaza and their government's complicity in the regime's crimes. According to local media, the demonstrators were calmly evacuated by police. French authorities confirmed last month that the match would go ahead as planned on November 14, sparking anger among pro-Palestine groups. The Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out new anti-Israeli operations, striking a number of the regime's vital targets deep inside the occupied territories. The umbrella group of Iraqi resistance factions said that its drones struck a vital target in the north of the occupied Palestinian territories twice. It added that two later operations on Tuesday morning hit a vital target in the port city of Haifa with drones. The Islamic Resistance says its operations are in support of the Palestinian and Lebanese people and in response to Israel's massacre of civilians, including women, children, and the elderly. It vowed to press ahead with its operations with increasing intensity. The group has also carried out many operations against U.S. bases in Iraq, neighboring Syria, over Washington's unbridled support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. Now to the occupied West Bank, where Israeli forces have carried out fresh raids in several areas, killing four more Palestinians. The regime's troops laid siege to and fired shells at a residential building in the town of Tamun, killing two Palestinian men. Local authorities have identified one of the victims as 47-year-old Hani Bani Auda Abu Asif. Also in Tamun, the Israeli military carried out drone attacks on several areas. Elsewhere in the West Bank, two more Palestinians were killed during a raid on Jenin. The regime forces stormed homes, fired live ammunition, and bulldozed infrastructure in other areas, including in the town of Kabatia. Meanwhile, the Hamas movement hailed the resistance in the West Bank and reminded that the Israeli killings will only strengthen the will of the Palestinian resistance and will never bring peace to the regime. Since the onset of the genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, nearly 800 Palestinians have also been killed in the West Bank. Our correspondent Naka Ahmed joined us earlier from Ramallah to give us more details about Israeli raids and killings in the occupied West Bank.
The IOF has announced that they will be performing a military action, as they have called it, a military action to many areas into the northern cities, including Aqaba, Araba, Qabatia, Bir el-Basha, Jalboun, and has already started bombing in Qabatia and Tamun since the hours of the morning. An Israeli drone directly fired a rocket towards a car in the area of Ash-Shuhada in Jenin, near Jenin, and killed two Palestinians, as the Palestinian Ministry of Health has just announced that indeed they have received two more Palestinian martyrs. And the initial information says that these two martyrs are brothers. These are only initial information. It has not been confirmed yet. Due to that, the event is still ongoing. The military raid is still ongoing into Tamun and into Qabatia. Also, in the northern areas, there have been many clashes in Wadi al-Far'a, in Jalboun, and in Qabatia, where the Palestinian resistance movement have announced that they were able to blow up many local-made bombs with the raiding forces into Qabatia and into Tamun.
Iran has successfully launched two new domestically made satellites into Earth's orbit, cooperation with Russia, using a Soyuz launch vehicle. The rocket carrying Kosar and Hudhud satellites blasted off in the early hours of Tuesday, signifying the developing space cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. Kosar is first space product of an Iranian knowledge-based company that began its designing in 2019. Images streamed from the satellite are expected to be used for agriculture and land surveying. Hudhud satellite is anticipated to provide data useful to agriculture, mapping, transport, and the environment. Its mission is to create a customized platform for providing Internet of Things services with international coverage and in remote areas. The two satellites now orbiting mark another yet aerospace achievements of Iran despite crippling Western sanctions on the country. Earlier we were joined by political analyst Bruno Biclini, who shared his views on this story with us. Here's what he had to say.
This is a wonderful situation. I can compare with Brazil. Brazil is the eighth economy worldwide and has abandoned the satellite program and concealed our satellite's launching base for United States. This is a deep presence of colonialism inside of Brazil. On the other hand, Iran, with huge sanctions, with, I would say, terror attacks sponsored by NATO and by Israel, is developing a huge and potential aerospace industry, including full space industry with those satellites. the U.S. strategy is blind and dumb because they have shown the Eurasian continent for themselves, and they strengthen the ties between Russia, which is a military power, and Iran, which is a technological power, to go together to develop an aerospace industry with common ground and without using the dollar. So the sanctions and the blockade has been turned against those who committed that, against United States, the SWIFT system, and the full Western banking system, because you are proving now, Iran is proving that it's totally possible to have scientific development and international trade without using the dollar.
Iran's foreign minister is in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad on an official visit as the head of a high-ranking delegation. Abbas Araghchi has met with his Pakistani counterpart, Senator Mohammad Ishaq Dar. Araghchi also sat down with Pakistan's chief of army staff, General Asim Munir. The Iranian foreign minister is scheduled to meet with Pakistan's prime minister, Shahbaz Sharif. Upon his arrival in Islamabad, Araghchi said that he will discuss regional developments, especially the threats posed by the Israeli regime and the existing regional crisis, with Pakistani officials. He added that the two countries will also discuss ways of countering such threats and mechanisms for reducing tensions in the region. He described Iran's relations with Pakistan as long-standing and based on the two countries' political, economic, and cultural commonalities. Nasser Kazmi joined us earlier with more details on Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi's visit to Pakistan.
The Iranian Foreign Minister is in Pakistan at the moment, and the main objective of his visit is to consult with the Pakistani top political leadership how to reduce the tensions in the Middle East, especially the arrival when the Foreign Minister of Iran came here in Pakistan last night. He talked to the reporters at the airport and said clearly that this visit is designed to reduce the tensions in the Middle East, as we all know that the hostilities of Israel is there in the Middle East, as tens of thousands of people have been killed in Gaza as well as in Lebanon. Pakistan always back Iran's stance on regarding the Israel. So Pakistan is a key ally of the United States, and United States is a key ally of Israel at the moment. So holding talks with Pakistani leadership could be fruitful. We have seen in the past that Pakistan has been a vocal supporter of Iran, especially when Israel launched attack on Iran and Pakistan condemned these attacks on it, and calling it the breach of international laws and the breach of sovereignty of an independent state. So in these circumstances, this visit is very crucial.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. That's bye-bye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. The
This is the part of this speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a thousand of veterans and active members in the sacred defense and the resistance field. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 25, 2024. All these countries, the US, the Soviet Union, and the NATO countries that were America's allies, and the Warsaw Pact countries that were allies of the Soviet Union, were waiting for an opportunity. Saddam provided them with that opportunity. He was a craving, power-hungry, greedy, arrogant, impudent, cruel, reckless person who was sitting behind Iran's borders. They provoked him, and he attacked our country. Today, some people within the country criticize the Islamic Republic. They say that the Islamic Republic is at odds or in conflict with the rest of the world. That isn't true. That's not how it is. If what is meant is that we aren't engaged in political or economic activities with the world, or that we don't interact or meet with them, then that is certainly not true. Today, we work with the entities and the countries in which more than half of the world's population lives. We meet, interact, and do business with them. The misleading ruckus that we sometimes hear from some individuals who claim we are at odds with everyone and that we are in conflict with everyone isn't true. No, we are not at odds with everyone. We aren't in conflict with everyone. If that's their intended meaning, it's incorrect. If they mean that we oppose the political order of the imperialism, then yes, that's true.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, just like at the beginning of the revolution, we oppose imperialism. We oppose U.S. dominance. Today, the Soviet Union no longer exists, but the U.S. stands at the front of the Western domineering countries. We see the results of their actions, the wars that are started, the injustices that occur, the discrimination that takes place, and the nations that are put under pressure. We are opposed to these things, and we express our opposition clearly. This is a situation that existed that day and it still exists today. However, it incited the attacks on Iran's borders at that time. And today, thanks to the steadfastness of the Iranian people and their powerful presence in various arenas, the enemies no longer have the audacity to attack our borders. Instead, they show their treachery, enmity, and hostility in other ways.
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost, you guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
As I look to the north, I see the fertile plains of Syria and Lebanon. In the east, the vast and bountiful valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates. and in the west, the land of the Egyptians. These were the words spoken by Menachem Begin, the former Prime Minister of Israel. However, his words were in contradiction with the previous discourse of the Zionists. Previously, the Zionists spoke of exile, the Holocaust, and oppression. But after formation of Israel, their language and speech changed. They utilized a new terminology that reflected a dangerous ideology. The Greater Israel. To them, the establishment of the Zionist regime on Palestinian land was just the beginning of a larger plan. Therefore, Ben-Gurion claimed, "This map is not our country's map." We have another map that future generations will implement. We must expand our territory from the Nile to the Euphrates. Look at the American Declaration of Independence. This declaration makes no reference to any specific boundaries. We are not compelled to define our borders. These were the words of former Israeli War Minister Moshe Dayan. He spoke of America, of occupation, the genocide of indigenous people, and land grab. In fact, Zionists had a strange plan. They wanted to model themselves after America and considered the conditions in a way that Palestine and its people resembled America and its native inhabitants. The Zionists saw themselves as sailors and explorers, with the difference being the Zionists considered the land of Palestine as their ancestral inheritance.
What kind of history is it that the Arabs live here for 2,000 years and they were kicked us, by us out? We lived here, sir, for the last 3,500 years and more. Now, we came back to the land of our ancestors.
In this way, all strategies used to occupy America were employed for occupying Palestine. Daydreaming begins. In their dreams, the Zionists rule over Palestine, from the Nile to the Euphrates, the Middle East, and even the world. The existence of counterparts in America and Europe would have facilitated the establishment of geopolitical relations and brought about political power for Israel, making it akin to a kind of global government. But such mentalities were dangerous and found opposition. Therefore, the creation of an organization for suppressing opponents was put on the agenda. This organization is called Anti-Defamation League, to suppress critics as a pressure group. With increasing economic power of the Zionists, the Anti-Defamation League influenced the American political arena and even the Council on Foreign Relations. Zionists in America and Europe received support and backing, while critics and protesters were suppressed. The establishment of the Zionist regime was highlighted under the pretext of the Holocaust. All the documents related to the Holocaust were doubted. Years later, criticism begins, and critics are pursued and even punished. Some of the most significant criticisms and revelations came from within the intellectual communities. Ilan Pappe, a professor of political science at the University of Haifa, addresses the issue of ethnic cleansing in Palestine in his book. Civilians were killed, villages were destroyed. At least 1 million men, women, and children were expelled from their homes. Ilan Pappe faced harsh reaction and was expelled from the university. Gradually, other intellectuals also speak out. Israel had a sinister and complex political plan in the form of colonial occupation executed in a brutal manner. The situation was alarming because Israel's crimes could be concealed. Martial laws have been enforced in Palestine for years, infringing upon the rights and freedoms of the people who were simply harassed and abused.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Yeah, the idea is that every Palestinian would feel the military is right here.
In fact, a dual judicial system had been established in Israel. Muslims were deprived of services, welfare, and basic rights.
And since 67, no more drilling, no more development, no more nothing. We stopped at this point.
They were arbitrarily detained and placed in narrow and solitary cells, mostly subjected to torture. Even though they were innocent, they were tried and sentenced in military courts. Strangely, upon release, they could be killed, even women and children. Israeli society bore many similarities to American society. Arabs were treated as African Americans, and they were more likely to be tried and imprisoned compared with the Zionists. A form of ethnic cleansing was underway, a combination of racism and systematic slaughter. The Zionists, who were complaining about Nazi German camps, had imprisoned Muslim people in a camp the size of Palestine.
This whole country is like a prison. We feel like birds in a cage. We have all the comfort and food we have, but we have no freedom. My life and existence is always being threatened.
Colonialism, apartheid, and occupation were underway. The immigrants did not have ideal conditions, especially those who arrived after the days of catastrophe or Nakba. They were not allowed to settle in large cities. Instead, they were settled in temporary camps and then transferred to settlements. The policy of settlement building was hostile, aiming to prevent the return of Palestinians, and was considered a form of defensive shield. The protests of Eastern Jews began in the summer of 1959, starting from the city of Haifa. The next wave of protests took shape in the following decades. African immigrants also felt a different form of racial discrimination in their bones. As protests became widespread in Israel, Israeli experts and sociologists became involved and realized that something from within was challenging Israel. A crisis. Israeli sociologist Jonathan Shapiro in his books refers to the crisis as a major factor. The Israeli elites were exploiting the people. The necessity of creating a so-called nation for Israel was carried out at the expense of oppression by the majority, and minorities were in the worst situation. The chaotic situation of the parties was the most important factor in the crisis. There was no guarantee of minority rights. Arabs were in isolation and regression, being used as cheap labor for menial jobs. Israel was introduced as a model where a few different individuals from different countries had successfully come together and formed a nation. These were references to the Ashkenazis, as well as important institutions and organizations such as Haganah, Jewish Agency, Theodor Herzl, Weizmann, Menachem Begin, Ben-Gurion, Ariel Sharon, and Central Committees were all Ashkenazis. Historical books taught in schools were also about the Ashkenazis. Other Jews had no share in historical books because they were considered backward and primitive. Historically, being Jewish or Arab was not an issue. Jews lived comfortably among Arabs, but with the formation of Israel, problems arose. The Israeli society was filled with hatred towards Arabs. Arab immigrants were forced to hide their Arab identity. Concealing their Arab identity and constant suppression had turned into self-hatred. The solution ahead was what had been used in America, the melting pot theory. According to this theory, individuals from different societies come together in one place and interact, and a new society is formed. A new society that, while being homogeneous, also possesses the individual and social characteristics of different social groups. But Ben-Gurion's melting pot had many flaws. Racism was the most significant challenge. The next challenge was the rule of the elites. The founders of Israel sought to have Israel ruled by the elites, similar to America. Thus, a specific class in Israel was empowered as the guardians and protectors of the fundamental values of society to prevent the masses from challenging the fundamental principles of Israel. The plan had many benefits for the Ashkenazis. In the Jewish history, there are also signs of a class of nobility that sacrificed part of the Jews in times of emergency. A combination of racism and racial discrimination, along with the rule of a group of dominant elites and nobles who sacrificed people for their own interests. What fate will it bring? Politically, since 1949, left-wing parties have come to power in Israel and formed cabinets. In 1977, Menachem Begin of the Likud party came to power. In the 1980s, the Shah's party gained power, but again, it is Likud that takes the lead in Israel. In the 1990s, a young politician in Israel rises to power, Benjamin Netanyahu. He is U.S. educated with strong connections, including with Mitt Romney, the U.S. presidential candidate, and Menachem Schneerson, an influential rabbi. He shook hands with chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat, plotted an assassination attempt on senior Hamas leader Khaled Meshaal, and has been embroiled in corruption and graft. But after the events of 2000 and Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon, Ariel Sharon comes to power. He is officially a criminal and has a long history of killing and crimes against Palestinians. In his record, the massacre of unarmed people in the village of Al-Kubaya and the Sabra and Shatila massacre stand out. The number of casualties resulting from Sharon's actions is never clear because he takes pleasure in burning Palestinians.
We warned.
When Sharon brings war and terror, he faces defeat. With Israel's defeat in the 33-day war, something in Israel is fundamentally hurt. security. The right-wingers attract people's attention with extremist slogans. Meanwhile, Netanyahu, who has the support of Jewish rabbis and American advisors, has a better position. He comes to power with numerous promises and, based on his business background, implements economic reforms to garner public satisfaction through economic growth. Ehud Barak was considered a tough opponent of Netanyahu's. In 1999, he came to power with a promise of ending the war in Lebanon. Ehud Barak was one of the main commanders in the Lebanon War. He had pursued advanced studies in systems analysis at Stanford University in America and logically had concerns about any Israeli action to take over Palestinian territories such as the West Bank, the Jordan River, and the Gaza Strip, which would officially lead to the formation of an apartheid regime. Because in the event of voting in Palestinian territories, Palestinians would definitely vote for the Palestinian government, posing a fundamental challenge to Israel. The Zionist solution to the problem was a perpetual siege and war with Palestine. That is why the Gaza Strip turned into a large prison. A few years later, when Ehud Barak becomes war minister, he proposes a solution to previous failures. War. During Operation Cast Lead, Israel attacks the Gaza Strip for 22 days. Phosphorus bombs rain down on the people. They attack rescue forces, hospitals, women, and even children. In this war, the infrastructure of Gaza is destroyed. Israeli soldiers abduct and use Palestinian children as human shields on the streets. Israel officially commits war crimes. However, this war did not bring any achievements. Ehud Barak, as a main culprit, steps aside to allegedly bring fresh blood into Israel's political system. He was seeking extensive changes, but his failure against the resistance leads to the resurgence of Netanyahu. Until Netanyahu, security took precedence over everything in Israel, and every issue became a matter of security. But during Netanyahu's tenure, Israel faces a new challenge. The challenge of extremism. As long as Israel was winning, militarism was considered an honor. The army was the best interpreter of the Torah, and Arab defeats added to the excitement. Meanwhile, Netanyahu, who considered himself an expert in terrorism, turns to terrorism and, on the other hand, tries to achieve concessions through negotiations. And then he seeks to attract the satisfaction of extremist Zionists. That is why the provisions of the Madrid and Oslo Accords are replaced in the Trump Peace Plan, or so-called Peace to Prosperity. In 2018, discrimination becomes legally apparent in Israel, and Israel violates all international resolutions. According to this law, Israel is exclusively identified as a nation-state of the Jewish people, perpetually denying the rights and privileges of Muslims and restricting the Arabic language. In 2021, four families in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem are ordered to leave their homes. They fall victim to the regime's strange judicial system, which confiscates Palestinian properties. A month later, a hardline representative, Itamar Ben-Gvir, sets up his office under a tent in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. He is an extremist Jew who had a picture of Baruch Goldstein fixed on the wall of his house. Goldstein was a terrorist who attacked unarmed worshippers during Ramadan, pouring their blood. When Ben-Gavir sets up a tent in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, the settlers storm in and the occupation of Palestinian homes begins. Creating tension and conflict, harassing and tormenting Muslims, forcing families to flee and replacing them with Jews was a permanent policy for occupying land and changing the demographic and identity of Jerusalem and Palestine so that other plans could be implemented thereafter.
You are stealing my house!
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it!
But militarily, especially after the 33-day war in 2006, the conditions of the battlefield had changed. Therefore, when an Israeli ship is attacked in 2021, it becomes clear that it was a retaliatory attack. Subsequent attacks seem to be responses to Israeli crimes. Israel, which thought it had created a constant nuisance for the resistance axis by cooperating in the production of Daesh terrorists, now finds itself in the midst of even a greater fire. In a society where any unethical relationships to achieve a goal were considered legitimate based on its teachings, there's also a dangerous extremist movement that try to remain hidden and never be revealed.
So the Arabs are not equal citizens here.
The extremist movement in the political arena of Israel was so influential that someone like Netanyahu, the main culprit in the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, came to power.
But he was there, and it didn't stop it.
The man in the blue t-shirt approached.
For this reason, Netanyahu tried to gather the approval of extremist groups for years.
To go back to Arab countries.
We have to kill him, and not because he's an Arab, because he's a terrorist. I think he should also kick out the family.
But extremism and racial discrimination not only face opposition from Palestinians, but also from the resistance front and other communities. Israel sees its security slipping away. Thus, Israel, which has historically oppressed people and plotted for the Middle East, finds itself on the path of contradictions in behavior and speech and the adoption of racist policies, leading to nothing but defeat and destruction.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles.
stories from different parts of the world on The Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers, dear sisters, salamun alaikum, so welcome. Today we have another interesting story on Lantern, this program. So we go for this story. Ali's Way or Training. The city of Kufa was the capital of the Islamic government. People from all over the world used to gather at that point to get the benefit of knowledge and learning from that great Islamic university. One of those days, two men came across each other in the vicinity of the city. One of them was Ali, the commander of the faithful, peace be upon him, and the other was a Christian who did not recognize him. The Christian man was moving toward the suburban area of Kufa, whereas Ali ibn Abi Talib was on his way to Kufa. They mutually agreed to accompany each other for a while, talking to each other so that they do not get tired. They reach a point where two ways split out, so that each one wanted to move one another in those two different roads. The Christian bade farewell and went on his way, but he observed that his Muslim companion, whose way was on the opposite side, was moving towards him. So he stopped and questioned him. "Don't you want to go to Kufa?" Ali ibn Abi Talib said, "Yes." The Christian man said, "Then why are you coming towards this direction?" Ali alayhi salam replied, "I wish to accompany you to a certain length of distance because our Prophet said, when two persons are together on a way, on a journey, companions, they get a right over each other. Now that you have got a right upon me, I go along with you up to a certain distance, so that I must pay you discharge that light of yours in this world. Then I will part off on my own way." The Christian man was much pleased and moved by his humanly attitude and conduct, and he liked this talk and said, "It's benefiting that I should also embrace Islam, which has such a culture and students." His amazement and astonishment was only too enhanced when he discovered that his travel companion is Ali, the ruler of Islam. So he immediately accepted and embraced Islam at his hand.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Lantern from iranradio.ir. Well, in this program, what we do is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to elaborate and talk some more details about these stories and the themes and lessons that we can take in order to make use of them as Muslims in our lives. Well, this episode of Lantern is about Imam Ali alayhi salam and non-Muslims. So, we are talking about the greatness of Imam Ali alayhi salam from the eyes of non-Muslims and in fact the way that he used to treat these people. So, from what the thinkers agreed on regarding Imam Ali alayhi salam was that he was qualified to be the teacher of mankind and the builder of a human civilization by utopian standards, not by the standards of the first Hijri century. His goal wasn't building an empire that would rule countries, but rather building an empire of ethics in the soul of people before building states, governments, and capitals. Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam was a flood of divine love that if people accepted it and searched for it, they would obtain deliverance from evils and generations would have been produced out of their wombs to love and get acquainted and cooperate with each other, reconcile between each other, build and enliven the world with goodness. Do not hold grudge against each other and do not exchange invasions and extermination. The perfect human is created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the most beautiful image. And this is what Imam Ali alayhi salam was like. But those who were during his time did not understand him, nor did they understand what he was calling for. Okay? Let's have a short break. Soon we will be back. Welcome back to your audience. Now about the way Imam Ali alayhi salam treated non-Muslims, there are numerous stories narrating his highly respectful and kind behavior towards non-Muslims.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
About the kindness and justice of Imam Ali alayhi salam with one of his non-Muslim subjects, I should refer to this story that Sha'bi, who was one of the companions of Imam alayhi salam, says, Sha'bi said one day Imam Ali alayhi salam went to the market and saw a Christian selling a coat of arms. Imam Ali alayhi salam recognized that coat of arms and said to the seller, "This is my body armor. Let us go to the judge of the Muslims." The Muslim judge was Shuraih, and Imam Ali alayhi salam himself had appointed him in that position. When they went to Shuraih, he said, "What is the matter, O Amir al-Mu'mineen?" Imam Ali alayhi salam responded, this is my coat of arms, which I have lost since a long time now." Then Shuraih asked the seller, "O Christian, what do you have to say?" The Christian seller says, "I am not accusing Amir al-Mu'mineen of lying, but the coat of arms is my property." So Shuraih turned to Imam Ali alayhi salam and says, "I do not see any ground on which you can take it from his position. Do you have a proof supporting your claim?" Since Imam Ali alayhi salam had no proof, he said, "Shuraih is correct in his judgment." On hearing that judgment, the Christian seller says, "I bear witness that these are the laws of the prophets. The leader of the believers comes to a judge appointed by himself, and the judge passes a judgment against him. By Allah, O Amir al-Mu'mineen, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah." Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Now that you have become a Muslim, it belongs to you." Then he carried it on a horse. And again, you know, you see how beautiful Imam Ali alayhi salam treated the non-Muslims. And there is another narration that a narrator said that one day an old blind person passed by him begging. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "What is this?" Those who were around him said, "He is a Christian." Imam Ali alayhi salam answered, "You have used him until he became old and incapable, and now you are depriving him of the benefits provided for him from the public treasury." This hadith shows how Imam Ali alayhi salam respected the needs and dignity of those people who are not like him in religion. And that is a great lesson for us. Okay, dear listeners, that was the time we had for this episode of Lantern. I really hope that you have enjoyed listening to this episode. Until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب
Media organizations broadcasting from the Gaza Strip totally destroyed. Palestine is of great importance to the world's media because of the events and developments that take place there every day. The Israeli occupation leaves no room for the Palestinians to spend a single day without inconveniences, and it does it through various means of repression, murder, confiscation of land, and desecration of sacred sites. And it makes it look like the Palestinians are the bad guys and the Israelis the good ones. This campaign of deliberate misinformation continued for decades, until the day came that the Palestinians could provide a narrative that debunked that of the occupation. Through local media, they reached out to the world, communicating their message, all the while aware of the risks involved.
As we know, there are a number of attempts to control countries by occupying the headquarters of television or the occupation of pub broadcasters. Israel was working on this aspect to hit the Palestinian media from the first moment through the creation of fear. These steps have failed as of the start and middle and end of this operation because Palestinian media was ever present, always at the scene. They plan for every upcoming Israeli operation, and the way we can tell something is going on is when Israel starts to attack the media and bring about fear and confusion.
Israel's branding of itself before the civilized world is a civilized and developed country with a national humanitarian project. I think the Palestinian press has managed and operated first and foremost based on a national theme dedicated to the homeland and national responsibility. We portray the image as it is. When Israel targets civilians and children, bombards houses, mosques, hospitals, organizations, and besieges an entire people, inform the civilized and free world about what Israel is doing. O civilized people and free nations, this is what Israel is doing to us.
What distinguished Al-Aqsa Media Channel in this war was the influence it had on the Zionist front. We were able, by the grace of God Almighty, to infiltrate Zionist media channels and broadcast to the resistance. As you know, the Zionist government and media follow Al-Aqsa Space Channel, and this is confirmed by a Zionist analyst. We could enter homes outside Palestine on TV and radio and show how the resistance succeeded. And this got into the minds of the Zionist enemy within their own and influenced their policies that took place in the 2014
war. This is what the Zionist occupation did not want their own people and the people of the world to see, that the Palestinian press has credibility over the news coming out of the Zionist press, which came from statements made by Israeli settlers. They don't have credibility, but the people believe Palestinian media, and this is the fruit of our determination and perseverance.
يعني هذه النظرية لم تأتي من فراغ بل أتت من مثابرة وأتت من تصميم.
The Israeli occupation and its army first tried to keep the media away from the scenes of carnage during the 2014 Gaza war, but when that didn't work, they went after the journalists. Some of the most important facilities destroyed by the Israeli occupation in 2014 were the five Al-Aqsa Media Network facilities.
The headquarters at Burj al-Shuruq Financial Management Office, the offices at Al-Nasr, and the office you are at now were all targeted, as well as the broadcast center.
We all felt like this was the end of us when the broadcaster was targeted. But we don't believe that we are more important than our children and our homes, and the future of Palestine and our feelings do not shy away from embarrassment. Our purpose is that our message to the people should not be disrupted, because we believe they need us every second. We were back on air after a few hours of the attack, which was met community.
The Al-Aqsa Media Network had aired resistance operational information that allowed the Palestinian resistance to feed a group of Israeli soldiers. An operational failure for Israel was not an option, and so they had to put a stop
to the leaking of the truth to the outside world, and then to replace the truth by way of omission or denial.
Repeat with me, Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty, Allah Almighty. No true God but Allah. Al-Qassam brigades have just captured a soldier.